It's 6 after 9. Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. The long journey of the Great Lakes Compact is a step closer to its conclusion, as the agreement is now in the hands of Congress. So what happens next? Well, that's what we're going to talk about this hour, among other things. And to help us navigate this watery issue, we are joined by David Natsker, Executive Director of the Council of Great Lakes Governors. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin by reviewing how we got to this point in the process. Give us the Cliff Notes version of how we got from point A to whatever point this is.
Well, the Cliff Notes version is in late 2005, the eight Great Lakes governors came together and endorsed the Great Lakes St. Lawrence River Basin Water Resources Compact. That compact was the product of about 5 years of negotiations among the governors and regional partners. And it reflects a comprehensive management plan for how to manage and regulate the use of Great Lakes water. Over the past several years, it has been adopted by each of the eight Great Lakes state legislatures. And now to become effective, Congress must provide its approval. Yesterday, measures were introduced in both chambers of Congress to provide Congress's approval. And it's been a very, very positive start to the congressional consideration and very hopeful in terms of looking at Congress's schedule for action and the likelihood of gathering their approval very soon.
It looks actually, according to published news reports in a number of newspapers around the upper Midwest, it appears there are at least 60 sponsors already in the House version, and at least one member of Congress indicated that the House would pass this before the end of the year. The Senate is a little bit more up for grabs. It's hard to ever predict what they'll do because the rules of the Senate are they're arcane, I think would be a nice way to say it. Have you gotten any inkling of any possible problems that you might run into in the Senate?
We're not aware of any problems at this time. Governor Doyle, who's serving as chair of the Council of Great Lakes Governors, just wrapped up a two-day trip here to Washington and met with congressional leaders from both chambers and committee leaders from both chambers, and the message was universally positive about their interest in moving ahead as quickly as possible. And it really is an illustration of the broad-based consensus in the region when you look at the co-sponsorship. Each of the 16 senators representing the Great Lakes states from both parties have signed on as original co-sponsors to the compact measure. And, of course, it has the support of both of the presumptive presidential nominees, Senator McCain from Arizona and Senator Obama from Illinois. So it really is a testament to the consensus that's been built in support of the compact, and we're hopeful that things will be moving forward very quickly. It's also very encouraging that a hearing has already been scheduled in the Senate. The Senate Judiciary Committee will be meeting next Wednesday, July 30th, to hold its first hearing on the compact, and that will be chaired by Senator Feingold. Certainly a credit to his leadership and Senator Coles that they were able to get that scheduled so quickly and hopefully get things moving toward congressional approval sooner rather than later.
What was the genesis of this agreement? I mean, how did this get started? Somebody sat down at breakfast one day and said, by golly, we need some sort of an agreement between the Great Lakes states about the water of the Great Lakes. How did it get started?
Well, it's really the result of a long series of different things that came together, beginning in the mid-80s with the governors working with one another through the Great Lakes Charter all the way up to 2005. But perhaps the greatest exclamation point on the urgency for moving ahead was provided in 1998. That's when a company based out of Ontario proposed to take water by tanker out of Lake Superior to Asia. And it really rang alarm bells around the region and around the country to think that there weren't adequate legal protections in place to prevent that kind of a thing. So the governors took a look at what was in place, consulted with regional partners, members of Congress, and others, and it was evident that some new protections were needed, and through the negotiation process and consultation, the governors became gravitating toward, I should say, the compact mechanism, because it is the strongest legal protection that the states can provide for the Great Lakes.
Well, there are a lot of states that have water compacts. Most, I think, something like more than 40 states are involved in at least one compact, and a number of states have multiple agreements. In the Southwest, there are a lot of agreements, for example, on what to do with whatever water is left in the Colorado River. And so these things across the U.S. are not that uncommon. Let's assume that the Great Lakes Compact gets the congressional approval that we expect. What happens then?
Well, first, just to be clear, there are about 200 compacts that are currently in place. More than 40 of them deal with interstate waters. And as you mentioned, 45 states and the District of Columbia are already a member of at least one interstate water compact. So these are devices that have been used over a long period of time by the federal government and by states to help manage shared waters. So there's a long tradition and history of using them in this way. Once Congress provides its consent, a compact council will be created of the governors, and they will then work into the future to provide a shared management framework for the Great Lakes. Each state will be adopting water conservation and efficiency programs. Each state will be adopting water management and regulatory programs to deal with uses within the Great Lakes Basin. And there also will be a prohibition generally on diversions of Great Lakes water, with limited, strictly regulated exceptions for communities that are on or near the basin divide. So those laws will be in place and will provide very strong protections for the Great Lakes.
Well, of course, water diversion was the item that made the always made the lead of news stories about the Great Lakes Compact, particularly in the early days of the discussion. And there was, you know, there was all this talk about the possible dry areas of the Southwest running a pipeline into Lake Superior and taking its water and so forth. One of the things, though, that whenever we do a show on the Great Lakes Compact, I always get a number of emails afterwards asking me why we didn't spend more time talking about water conservation. So I was glad to hear you mention that. Those of us who live along the lake use a lot of lake water. What does the compact do in terms of getting us to be more careful with that?
A great question. And you're right. Most of the headlines have gravitated toward the diversion issue, and that's an important element that shouldn't be lost. However, in the near term and arguably in the longer term, one of the more significant, if not the most significant, impact of this compact will be felt by users within the Great Lakes Basin. And there will be a new management and regulatory program in place in each of the states, or an update to those states that already have programs. And they'll have to look at things like ensuring that future water users aren't causing significant environmental harm to the Great Lakes. They'll have to incorporate water conservation and efficiency into their future uses, and also demonstrate that they're being responsible stewards of the waters. Above and beyond that, each state will be putting in place a water conservation and efficiency program that will deal with all water users, existing users as well as future users. And those programs can be voluntary or mandatory or some mix thereof. Wisconsin's already started the process of developing its program by developing some broad-based objectives that can help guide the state's program. Those were introduced earlier this month for public comment, and would certainly encourage people to visit the Department of Natural Resources website if they have an interest in weighing in on these objectives, which will help to shape the state's future action. But water conservation and efficiency is a growing need and something that people are embracing more and more every day as we realize, even in the Great Lakes region, that water is not the limitless, infinite resource that we once thought it was. It is something that is vulnerable, and we need to be good stewards and make sure that we're using it responsibly. And the compact will help us do that.
Well, it's interesting. I think in my own case, I just in the last few years moved from the city out into a rural area where I have a well. I'm fortunate to have an artesian spring, so I don't have any shortage of water. But we have a septic holding tank, which has to be pumped when it's full. And I'll tell you what, if you're in a situation like that, you start thinking about water conservation really quickly, because everything you use has to be disposed of one way or another, and it's that gets to be an expense. I was wondering what kind of, is there going to be some sort of marketing plan that goes along with this to try and make people more aware? When I lived in town, I'll be real honest with you. I mean, I turned the water tap on, and if I was brushing my teeth, I didn't turn it off. You could take showers that were really long, didn't have to worry. Well, you might run out of hot water if your water heater wasn't up to snuff. But, you know, when you live in town and there's a municipal water supply, I don't think most of us think about the water we're using or where it goes or what happens to it when we're done with it.
No, most people don't think about it, and most of us take it for granted, and that's because we've been blessed with arguably the world's greatest freshwater resource. About 20% of the world's surface freshwater is in the Great Lakes, and it's a tremendous resource, not only wonderful for the environmental benefits it provides and the fishery and all the other things that we can enjoy in the outdoors, but also as an economic asset. It is the driver for much of our regional industry, and of course our nation's economy depends on that. It's also an important transportation vector with intra-lake shipping and also ocean-bound shipping that moves freight and cargo around the world from our Great Lakes. So it is becoming increasingly recognized that it is of tremendous value and is something we need to be proactive in taking steps to protect. You mentioned the costs that you incurred with your own well on your own property. When you think about magnifying that out by a factor of 10 or 100 or 1,000 or a million for a large agricultural operator or for an industry, you can understand very quickly why many of them have been such good stewards over the past, because it directly affects their bottom line. Conservation is in their own economic self-interest, and it's very gratifying that the agricultural industry and many of the industries around the lakes have so broadly embraced the compact. Of course, there is an education process that needs to take place to make people aware of why we're doing this and what could be done to better protect the Great Lakes. That process is already underway, and the state of Wisconsin and the other states are already doing a number of things to encourage better stewardship and more efficient use of the Great Lakes, everything from water pricing to municipal education to a variety of other things. So really, the key is not to reinvent the wheel, but to build upon what's already being done successfully.
We're discussing the Great Lakes Compact, which is now in the hands of Congress. It's expected that it will be approved and will become the law of the land. And we're talking about, well, what happens then, what we're going to do about conserving water in the Great Lakes Basin and taking care of this wonderful natural resource that we have been given access to here. I would invite people to call and talk about what you think ought to be done in terms of water conservation, how we can be good stewards of the Great Lakes. Those of us that live along them, we have an obligation. It's been agreed that we need to take care of this resource and make sure that it's there for our children and grandchildren to use. Well, join us by phone or email. Here are the phone numbers, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's a local call for you. Please use 414-227-2050, 227-2050. The email address is talk@wpr.org. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have some callers who want to join us and talk about this issue, and you can be one of them. Stay tuned. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 1 minute after 9 o'clock, you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on the Ideas Network. After 2 on Talk of the Nation, a mystery writer suffered a stroke that left him able to write, but doctors told him he would never read again. Howard Engel is the man who forgot how to read. After 2 today on Talk of the Nation here on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about the Great Lakes Compact. It's one step closer to concluding as it's now in the hands of Congress, which is expected to make this compact the law of the land. And that will end, or at least will mark a major turning point in the life of this agreement. And we have here to discuss the issue with us the Great Lakes Compact, David Nafsker, Executive Director of the Council of Great Lakes Governors. And we've spent some time talking about how we got to this point and some things that the compact will do. And one of the areas that we've touched on is water conservation. And those of us who are citizens here in the Great Lakes Basin, what we need to do to be better users or stewards of this tremendous water resource that we sit on. And we're inviting people to call in and talk about that or any other issue related to the Great Lakes Compact. Please join us. Our lines are full right now, but you can send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. We'll go to the phones, and let's take a call from John in Washara County. John, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you, John, so much for filling in for Kathleen Dunn. You do a great job. I enjoy listening to you a great deal.
Thank you.
My comment has to do with stewardship. And, you know, we all have to be better stewards of land and water resources, and as the future progresses, it's going to be commonplace. But in my opinion, I think industry has a bigger responsibility than they have now. And concerning invasive species, in my field that I work in, wastewater and water treatment, we have many, many technologies that I think the shipping industry, for one, can be using as far as membrane technologies. And, you know, we can filter things out down to 0.5 microns. And there's no reason where we should be allowing any zebra mussel villagers into our Great Lakes systems. And I think it may even take care of some of the VHS problems that we have right now. So I'd like your comment from your guest, please.
Well, thanks for the call. Invasive species is one of the greatest challenges facing the Great Lakes. And as you alluded to, one of the main ways in which these are being introduced into the Great Lakes is by ocean-going shipping. It's been the likely way in which zebra mussels, quagga mussels, round gobies, and a number of other species have made their way into the Great Lakes. And dealing with those, trying to manage them once they're into the system, is very costly and very difficult, and one that the ecosystem has suffered from, and of course our economy as well. When you talk about the wastewater industry that you're involved with, or industrial uses where zebra mussels are clogging pipes and intakes and things of that nature, it's a tremendous cost to the bottom line, not to mention the environmental impacts. So the governors have been eager to see federal action on this issue and have been pushing Congress to try to put something in federal law for a number of years. Unfortunately, it's been impossible to reach consensus and get something implemented into law. So this discussion continues, and we're continuing to try to push to see something done. The longer that process goes on, the more individual states try to step up and do what they can. Of course, a patchwork of 8 different standards and 8 different approaches is never going to be effective as one that could be taken by the federal government. So we're hopeful that members of Congress will take that responsibility seriously and be able to do something very soon. The pace has been very frustrating, and there's been a lot of disappointment about the lack of federal action to this point.
John, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Patrick in Schaumburg, Illinois. Patrick, good morning.
Hi, good morning. My concern is with the draining of Lake Michigan and so forth for our water supply. In the past, we're on well water, watering your yards, flowers, and so forth, the golf courses. The water went back into the water table. Now we're just draining the lakes. It's down quite a bit. You look at Montrose Harbor in Chicago or Waukegan Harbor and so forth. The water's not even close to some of the piers anymore.
Okay, Patrick, thanks for that. What about water levels in the Great Lakes? Where's the water going?
Water levels have been low and near historic lows over the past 6 to 12 months, although they've rebounded somewhat from where they were earlier this summer. There's a natural variation to the lakes themselves. Over about a 30 or 40-year cycle, the lakes ebb and flow several feet in some instances, depending on where you are, and one or two vertical feet horizontally, of course, can mean a great deal. If you look up in Door County or some of the other areas around the state, a loss of 1 or 2 feet of depth can expose tens, if not hundreds of feet of new beaches. And that creates big problems for dock owners, for people that have water intakes, and for many other people as well. it's very difficult to discern what the effect of human use of the lakes is versus these natural variations. But the compact will help us to make sure that we have a forward-looking, proactive management approach in place so that we can try to keep those lakes at healthy levels and minimize the negative effect of human use in forcing those water levels even lower. It's a difficult challenge and one that many people are working to try to get a better handle on. The compact is an important part of that process.
Now, doesn't the compact specify that if you take water out of the lake, it has to go back in?
Yes, less whatever amount is used or consumed. So if you're talking about a homeowner, of course, you take in water through your sink or your plumbing, and some amount of that water may be lost, whether it's used for drinking water, watering your lawn, or whatever the case may be, before it goes down your pipes and into the sewage system to be treated and then returned to the system. So it's recognized that some amount of water will be lost as a normal function of water use, but as a general matter, yes, the water will have to be returned after use under the compact's provisions.
Let's go next to Louise in Milwaukee.
Yes, my question has to do with the definition of the divide. I understand from past articles in the newspaper and so forth that the divide has traditionally been defined topographically, and as near basin communities wanted to be included in the divide, there were proposals to define the divide subterraneanly. Does the compact clearly define the word divide?
Great question, and particularly relevant for states like Wisconsin and Ohio, Indiana, and others where part of the state is inside of the Great Lakes Basin and part of the state is outside of it. There's a subcontinental divide that was created geologically, and inside of the Great Lakes Basin, inside of that divide, water drains toward the lakes and then ultimately out into the St. Lawrence River. Outside of that basin divide, water in Wisconsin would drain toward the Mississippi River and down into the Gulf of Mexico. The watershed divide has been one that's been recognized under law for many years at the federal and at the state level. So it's something that there's some experience and history in using. The divide is defined and is illustrated on some maps that have been put together over time. It becomes particularly relevant, though, when you start talking about groundwater issues, which are historically very difficult to understand and to manage. Groundwater, of course, does not behave just like surface water. So it's recognized that there may be some flows and interactions between those groundwater and surface water resources that might not be very well understood. The compact provides a clear management framework, though, which says whether you're on groundwater or surface water, if you are inside the Great Lakes Basin, you would be subject to the in-basin management program. If you are outside of the surface water basin, you would fall under the diversion provisions. And as a general matter, those would be prohibited except for the strictly regulated exceptions for communities on or near the basin divide. So that's the general approach that's reflected in the compact.
Louise, thank you for that call. Let's go next to Mark in Green Bay.
Hello.
Mark, good morning.
I was wondering how Chicago gets away with siphoning water off of Lake Michigan so much, especially through the Chicago River and through and the fact that the basin is very small in Illinois. The Great Lakes Basin is not very large, but a lot of water seems to be going out through Illinois.
Great question. About 100 years ago, the flow of the Chicago River was reversed. Naturally, the Chicago River, which drained much of the Chicago metropolitan area, flowed into Lake Michigan. And before modern water treatment facilities were put in place, of course, sewage, in many instances untreated, was being discharged into the Chicago River and then ultimately into Lake Michigan, which at that time and today was the drinking water supply for the city of Chicago and surrounding communities. So there was a real public health problem. And as a result, the Army Corps of Engineers developed a scheme to reverse the flow of that Chicago River so it would then take water from Lake Michigan, drain it out, and ultimately push it toward the Mississippi River system. Years and years of litigation ensued with people concerned on the one hand about being the new recipients of this wastewater discharge in downstream areas in Missouri and elsewhere, and on the other hand, the Great Lakes states that were concerned about what this might be doing to lake levels. So over the course of 100 years, different decisions were made by the U.S. Supreme Court, and the current framework that's in place limits the volume of water that can be diverted out the Chicago River to about 2.1 billion gallons a day. It's interesting to note that while that is a tremendous volume of water, it's actually less than the man-made diversions into the lakes that have been put in place over time. Several of those are up in Canada that were built and begun operation around the wartime that move water that would ordinarily go up to the Hudson and James Bay and push it into the Great Lakes. So over time, we've manipulated the system and developed different processes and procedures to deal with these various human interventions and continue to try to work with them in a framework that overall enables the lakes to maintain themselves at healthy levels and continue to be able to have a way to use them sustainably.
Thanks for that call, Mark. We're going to go to another Mark. This one is in Ashland, of course, on the shore of the greatest of the Great Lakes, Lake Superior. Mark, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. I have a question or comment I'd like to make that's, I don't know, it disturbs me. It's so counterintuitive. This town, Ashland, we live on a large bay of Lake Superior, Shawamigan Bay. We send all of our sewage into the lake. I know it's treated supposedly the best filter systems in the world. This is common. Superior, Duluth, Thunder Bay, up in the UP, most towns do it. But then we turn around and take our drinking water directly out of the lake. And I know that it's filtered and chlorinated. Our city water facility sends us every year a little statement with what's in our water, how pure our water is. And now, well, now I guess this has been for some time, but, you know, our water is heavily treated with a number of chemicals I can't even pronounce. And some of these chemicals have been called into question as to how good they're for you and how much of them your system can handle. We don't really know. These are kind of like an uncontrolled experiment. And I just want to talk about that. I'd like a little bit of discussion on, you know, how wise is this dumping our sewage into the greatest body of fresh water on the planet and then turning around and chemically treating the heck out of our water and drinking it? It upsets me. You know, I know I'm not the greatest technological guy. You know, maybe all these chemicals aren't going to hurt us, but I'm just not terribly trusting of the industry. I'm sorry.
You're concerned. We get it. Thanks for the call, Mark. Mr. Nasker?
Well, I would say a couple of things. Firstly, there are a lot of pollution issues, and those are dealt with by state and federal law, and there are a number of chemicals of emerging concern and ones that have recently become more widespread in their use that we don't understand very well what might be the long-term effect on human health. So there's a lot of research going on and rigorous standards at both the state and federal level to ensure that we're doing all that we can to make sure that people's drinking water supply is secure and is protective of public health. One of the other issues, though, that you dealt with is maybe even a harder one to overcome, and that's kind of the yuck factor. As water becomes more and more scarce, a lot of areas of the country and of the world are looking at recycled water as a resource that could be reused, and in some instances being reused for home use, drinking water. And that's a real difficult thing to get people to get their mind around, that somehow the water, after it goes out of their home through their toilet or other plumbing, can be treated to a level that is safe and that can be used again and again and again. They are being forced to try to do that in areas where water is particularly scarce, and it just, you know, it jibes very poorly with the mind when you think about the idea itself. So we're blessed in the Great Lakes that those kinds of extraordinary measures haven't had to be taken in our area. But there is some gray water recycling and things of that nature that's being used for golf course irrigation or other uses, and it does help to lessen the burden on our infrastructure so that we can invest more heavily in treatment facilities and other kinds of things.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because I was recently in Florida and I was noticing they had little signs on some of the boulevards and places where they had all this lush vegetation, saying that these areas were had been watered basically with gray water.
And that was the other thing I was thinking about, which is the move toward green infrastructure and kind of these more sustainable, more traditional kinds of ways of managing wastewater. That wastewater, provided it can be treated to a certain level, is a resource and can be used for irrigation or other kinds of things. Also, the solid waste that's collected in a number of municipal facilities, like Milwaukee, can be converted into a fertilizer, Milorganite. And so these are the kinds of things that we need to be looking at more creatively to take what's been a problem, a lemon, and turn it into lemonade, a resource. So those kinds of things are becoming increasingly widespread, and ones we have to overcome people's initial apprehension to get beyond it, and also make sure that there are clear reassurances to the public that these things can be done safely.
Yeah, you still have the yuck factor, though. I think I'm with Mark on that one. Where did I want to go next? How about Steve in Lake Geneva?
Yes,
Steve,
good
morning. Good
morning. My question is, in what ways might the Great Lakes Water Compact affect the approval of additional conventional power generation capacity within the Great Lakes water basin? And by power generation, I'm referring to additional coal and nuclear baseload capacity.
Well, the compact itself would provide a framework for the individual states to review and make decisions focused on the water use itself. So things that would be analyzed would include the volume that's being used. Is it reasonable for the kind of facility that's being proposed? Do they have appropriate conservation and efficiency technologies and practices that they'd be putting in place? Will the water be returned at an appropriate location and an appropriate volume and things of that nature? The compact itself would not deal with encouraging one type of fuel over another, nor would it get into managing or regulating air discharges or pollutants or anything of that nature. Those are all dealt with separately under different state and federal laws. But it does provide an additional layer of protection, and a very important one, for the water quantity that would be used by those kinds of facilities. Of course, power generation is one of the largest uses around the Great Lakes Basin, particularly cooling towers, but also the ones through facilities. Use a tremendous amount of water to cool their pipes and to be involved in the generation process. So it's an important protective mechanism that would be applied to power facilities and all others as well.
Steve, are you still there?
Yes. I was just curious, what overall net effect do these conventional power facilities have on the water quality, on aquatic organisms, the biota, so to speak, of the Great Lakes waters?
It's a difficult question. There are clearly some localized impacts that are felt as a result of the quantity of water that might be felt, and depending on the source of the water, whether it's being taken directly from the lake, from a stream, from groundwater, although that's relatively rare for a power generation facility. But there would be impacts in terms of pollutants that would be discharged, and those are all regulated under federal and state law. And then also water temperature, which has been a particular concern for those once-through cooling facilities where water is taken in, circulated around warm pipes or boilers or what have you, and then discharged back into the source water at a higher temperature. That can have an impact on fish health and a variety of other things. So that's something that federal and state regulators look at very closely when considering an approval for any kind of a new or expanded power facility.
Yeah, water temperature has been a real issue. It's been a major news story. There's been a lot of discussion about that, particularly, I believe, and Steve may have been alluding to this, there are some proposed new plants for Wisconsin and water temperature and its effect on organisms within the lake, not just fish, but the things that fish feed on and so forth, and how water temperature affects them. So that could be a key issue going forward here. We're going to take a break, and we'll have there'll be a line opening up for you very quickly if you want to still join us. Plenty of time to call 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or 227-2050. If you get a busy signal, go ahead and send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:43. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next hour, my guest and I will discuss what's right and what's wrong with the global food system. I'll be talking with Paul Roberts, the author of a book titled The End of Food. So maybe you want to eat a good meal before that program. This hour, we're talking about the Great Lakes Compact. It is, it's been ratified by the states or approved by the states that it encompasses, and it is now in the hands of the United States Congress, which needs to give its stamp of approval, and then it will become the law of the land. And our focus today isn't so much on the congressional approval process. We did talk about that earlier in the program, and in case you just joined us, it looks very good, very favorable in both houses of Congress that this will pass, will be approved, and will become the law of the land. So we've moved on from that, and we're talking about what's next. What happens when this compact is in force, and what can we do to keep this issue top of mind? For example, to talk about conservation of water resources, how we use them for industrial and our individual purposes, what can be done and what the compact contains in terms of new incentives or regulations regarding those issues, and how the states are going to be able to work together to manage this Great Lakes resource that we have. So those are some things we've been talking about. We've got callers on the line. I should reintroduce my guest. He's David Nasker, Executive Director of the Council of Great Lakes Governors. And, of course, the Great Lakes Governors were the group that got together and approved the original language of the compact in 2005, and then it went to state legislators, and they took it from there, and now it's in the hands of Congress. And now it's in your hands at 800-486-8655 and 227-2050. And, well, that line just filled up. So we should have full phones now. So let's get some calls on the air. We'll go to Bud in Sturgeon Bay next. Bud, good morning.
Good morning, John. Thank you for another good show. Mr. Nasker, welcome. I agree a lot with the gentleman, Mark, from, I guess it was Ashland. I'm a common sense kind of guy. I don't understand the difficulty in solving these problems. I applaud the ratification of the Great Lakes Compact, and I have what might be a suggestion for maybe an oversimplistic solution, but the people that listen to public radio like your show here generally are stewards, are interested in, just because of their affiliation, just because of their political attitude. There's a great mass of people out there that just don't care. They're so busy getting their next Hannah Montana record and getting iPods for their kids that they just aren't concerned about the environment, because water comes out of the tap and they pay for it and that's it. Why don't we just have a graduated system of rates applicable to water usage? The information that's available at the county level and the state level as to persons per household and typical industrial uses. We can charge for a conservational approach that a household or an industry uses at a reasonable rate. But the people that don't, that use it willy-nilly or irresponsibly should pay a very advanced rate. We just got to stop, because the masses aren't listening to programs like this. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you, guys. Bye.
Thanks for the call, Bud. What about it? Should people who don't use water responsibly have to pay more for it?
It's a great question. The whole issue of water pricing is a difficult one, but it's a very important incentive, a very important driver for encouraging people towards certain behaviors and using water more responsibly. There are graduated rates, declining rates, different kinds of things. Historically, the utilities have wanted to ensure that everybody had access to the water that they would need for household use at a reasonable price and provided for through the public utility. There are some instances around the Great Lakes area and, of course, other parts of the country and the world where there are some private utilities as well, and they're playing an increasingly larger role in providing water service to individuals. But pricing really is just one part of the equation. You look at how water gets used and where opportunities are for conservation and efficiency. Some of the things that don't necessarily make people all that excited, like leak detection and repair, can have a tremendous impact on how much water gets used and how much gets wasted. Utilities have been underfunded in many instances and haven't had the resources to be as aggressive as they might like about leak detection and repair, trying to provide incentives to homeowners to put in more efficient plumbing fixtures, educating people about how they use water and how they might be able to reduce their water footprint. All of these come together, along with water pricing, as elements of a comprehensive water conservation and efficiency program. And the state of Wisconsin's been a real leader in trying to build on existing efforts, but also do some things that can be cutting edge and experimenting with some different ideas to see how they work and make it as easy as possible for the people. The caller was absolutely right. That needs to be a focus of trying to make this as simple as possible so that people can make decisions easily or without even really having to think about it that result in a good, positive, healthy environment and a good, sustainable use of the Great Lakes.
Well, I know in those communities that have sewer taxes that are at 100% or even more of your water bill, it makes you think twice before you water your lawn, I'll tell you that much. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, no question about that.
Let's go next to Paul in New Berlin. Paul, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
You're on the air.
Thank you. Regarding the watering the lawns, another issue is the growing of food locally. And even there's farmland out here in New Berlin that straddles the subcontinental divide. And it will be, under the compact, available for water from the Great Lakes. And that water and sewer-type services obviously are enablers of an urban development, higher density. But just because that water is available, I don't know that it's a smart policy decision to actually put that in, because as more of New Berlin and other areas that have been dependent on groundwater for their supply go to Great Lakes water, some of the issues of wet basements and a rising of the groundwater table will occur. In order to offset that, the new balancing effect of Great Lakes water being provided, I think a lot of water should be that's available for irrigation for farmland should be used as such, and those areas maintained to grow food for the urban area. So there's a lot of land use issues that, because of the money that is to be made by using Great Lakes water for urban development, that what is in the compact in Wisconsin is being set in place in order to ensure comprehensive planning so that we do have locally grown produce and maybe provisions for local municipalities to reallow the opening of private wells for watering their lawns rather than requiring everybody to be on the municipal water system. So there has to be a new balance found between groundwater usage and Great Lakes water usage in order, I think, to maintain a good, healthy status quo for this whole region.
Paul, thanks for the call. Mr. Nasker?
Well, you raise a number of different issues, and I think what I could speak most directly to is that the compact will help to provide a framework to make sure that all of the uses collectively are sustainable. By looking at future uses and making sure that they can demonstrate they won't have environmental harm, that they're incorporating water conservation and efficiency, Over time, we're going to see more sustainable Great Lakes, and we're going to see uses that work with one another in a complementary fashion. We want to avoid that race to the bottom where everyone's grabbing as much as they can and avoiding some of the conflicts that we've seen in other parts of the world. So this is a very useful framework to help to make sure that we are doing things in harmony with one another. The local land use issues are a whole other side of the equation, and one that are dealt with by local authorities. Of course, there are a variety of different things that they have to take into account with zoning decisions and utility needs, infrastructure, road service, all those kinds of things. And I know that those are very, very difficult ones that are wrestled with at the local level. But many, many local leaders have looked at the compact as a complementary tool to help them manage all of this growth in a more sustainable fashion. And Mayor Civitero from New Berlin certainly is one of them.
Paul, thanks for that call. I had an email from Bill in Port Wing asking, what about the bottled water loophole in the compact? Could you address that issue very quickly?
I appreciate the call. There's been a misconception about the whole bottled water issue. Bottled water would be managed and regulated by the individual states just as they would be managing and regulating any other kind of use. Where the question has come in is whether a bottle of water being transported from the Great Lakes Basin to an area outside the basin ought to be considered a diversion. And the approach that's reflected in the compact is the one that's been in place in Ontario, Quebec, and the rest of Canada for about 10 years now. And it says that water in containers larger than 5.7 gallons that are being transferred out of the watershed would be considered a diversion and generally prohibited. In containers smaller than that size, they would be managed and regulated by the individual state. So it's a management framework that's worked successfully in some very similarly situated jurisdictions, and one that's been part of a package that's attracted very broad-based support. So we're somewhat puzzled by the concern that's been raised more recently, and continue to try to provide good answers so that people do have good information about what's in the compact and what's not.
Let's take a call next from Ann in Manitowoc. Ann, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just a comment. I teach elementary school, and I went to an in-service this past year put on by this group that is for protecting the Great Lakes. I don't remember the particular name. But they gave us a lot of ideas on how to integrate science and using the Great Lakes in our curriculum. But one of the main things I took away from that is that kids and families don't connect with Lake Michigan anymore. We don't picnic on the lake. We don't, like, take walks on the lake. And they really encouraged us as teachers and as parents to do more of that. Just go down the lake and, like, skip rocks and just enjoy it. Because there seems to be, like, a real disconnect now to the Great Lakes and to Lake Michigan in particular. So I thought that was real interesting. You know, it's how our world has changed a lot. So so when we hear programs like this, to make them more applicable to our world, which is we need to hang out on the lake more often.
And appreciate it more. Thanks for that call, Ann. What about it? Are we going to have some programs in place to help us appreciate what we have a little bit more?
I hope so. It's a great point. We too often turn on our faucet, and when a child asks, where does the water come from, we say, right here out of the tap. Or we go to the grocery store and teach our children by example that where we get the food is the grocery store rather than from the farm or from the outdoors. So it's a great point, and one that we do need to reinforce. We've become increasingly disconnected from our natural environment. You see that in the lower numbers of people going to our national and state parks, and you see it with children becoming increasingly disconnected from the outdoors. So anything that teachers and schools can do to help reinforce that connection, it really helps ingrain in everyone's mind, and particularly young people, that what they do has an impact on the natural environment, and the natural environment has an impact on them. We need to be thinking in an integrated way about those relationships and doing all we can to be good stewards and good as citizens to one another and to our environment.
Maybe we need a video game titled Grand Theft Great Lakes.
Let's hope we don't need that.
Okay. Well, maybe the Great Lakes should have its own agent or something, a publicist at any rate. Thank you so much, Mr. Napsker, for spending this hour with us. It's been a pleasure talking to you and very informative.
Thank you very much for having me.
David Napsker is Executive Director of the Council of Great Lakes Governors. John Anderson and Rhonda Fanning produced this program. John Treader handled the phones for us this morning. And if you'd like to hear it all again, you can go to our website, WPR.org, and listen to it all over again. Or you can order a compact disc by calling the radio store at 800-747-7444 and asking for program 724D. We're going to talk about food and the possible lack of it next hour, so stick around. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network.